Every Wednesday, William Henry's revelations bring you a powerful half hour of information at the cutting edge of reality. Information that you cannot find anywhere else in the world. And now, here's William.
This is William Henry. This is Revelations. Welcome, everyone. Why should we investigate ancient sacred science? What's the use in studying ancient texts or obscure myths? People ask me such questions quite frequently, and the answer I propose comes from numerous chronicles of figures such as Enoch and Elijah and others who devoted their lives to the discovery of the secrets of sacred and ancient lore. The reason they devoted their lives this way was because they knew that one day they might find themselves in a, quote, interview, unquote, with a higher being who would reward them with a sacred book, a tablet, or stone of secrets. In order to get this interview, one had to master this lore so that they could even apply for the job to begin with, and then get the stone if they were lucky and go on to the next level. One of the names of this stone is the Philosopher's Stone. Another name is the Tablet of Destiny. Today's guest, Dr. Joseph Farrell, has looked deeply into the subject of the Philosopher's Stone. In his new book, The Philosopher's Stone, Alchemy and the Secret Research for Exotic Matter, he frames the stone in the words of modern physics. Dr. Farrell followed his early passion for physics, mathematics, music, and ancient texts all the way to the University of Oxford, where he received a Ph.D. in patristics, the study of the early Christian fathers, from the University of Oxford in 1987. His interest in utilizing modern science to interpret ancient texts and esoteric traditions continued throughout his studies. His father, an engineer, first piqued Joseph's interest in the Great Pyramid during a family vacation, and this interest has continued throughout Joseph's life. He became the author of the Giza Death Star and the Giza Death Star deployed, and most recently, the Philosopher's Stone. Joseph, welcome to Revelations.
Hi, William. Thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure to talk with you, sir. It's really an incredible area that you research. You have put together one of the most impressive bodies of work on the secrets of the ancients, on the Nazis and their pursuit of occult technology, mm-hmm. and now you've moved to the Philosopher's Stone.
Mm-hmm.
The Philosopher's Stone, Joseph, what is it?
Well, as you know, if you read alchemical texts, it's really kind of a twofold thing. It, first of all, is a stone that supposedly is capable of stone or an elixir or a powder in some instances that's capable of transmuting base metals into gold. And then at a kind of an esoteric level, it stands for a symbolism, if you will, of mankind being able to transform himself into pure gold. In other words, to leave off the dross of the passions and sins and so on and so forth and become a pure being. But my interest is particularly on the physical side, on the stone itself, and this claim that it was able to transmute base metals, basically tin, lead, and so on, into gold.
Now, you trace this stone, mm-hmm. the Philosopher's Stone, to an ancient cosmic war in the Tablets mm-hmm. of Destiny.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that connection for a moment.
Well, as you know, in the Sumerian tablets, the Tablets of Destinies are these very mysterious objects. And, you know, I don't claim to have been able to figure them out any better than anyone else. I make a few educated guesses. But one of the things that's claimed for them is that some of them are claimed to have been indestructible. And that is precisely one of the claims that you see in alchemical literature for the Philosopher's Stone. In fact, some alchemists call it the indestructible stone. So that makes me think that what's really in play here is a deep physics of the physical medium itself, because the physical medium, space-time itself, is in a certain sense indestructible. So I think there's your connection.
And the gods actually battled over, over control of these stones.
Oh yes, absolutely they did. If you read these Sumerian texts, it's very, very clear. You know, it's almost in a peculiar way, it's like reading kind of a modern version of nuclear proliferation, because you have some people wanting this technology and actually stealing it, and then you have other people or other gods fighting for control of them to gain them back. So you have these tremendously destructive wars fought over these things. And if you make the alchemical connection then, you have to say that in a certain sense alchemy is that whole science and technology gone underground, and you see these alchemists making the claim that they are really trying to restore or recover all of this lost science.
And I want to insert here that one of the gods most closely identified with these stones or tablets, and also with alchemy, is the Sumerian god Enki.
Oh yes, Enki is a crucial figure. Enki, he's also known as Ea, sometimes Erikal, and in the Greek Heracles, of course. But Ea is basically kind of how does one put it? A sorcerer, kind of an imp. He's kind of a Loki character if you're familiar with Norse mythology. But he also, in the Sumerian tablets, is also the god that is directly involved with the creation of mankind. So you have this very peculiar individual involved in all of these activities. And again, his involvement with mankind would seem, again, to invoke an alchemical metaphor, because in the Sumerian text, it's very clear that he's taking a pre-existing being and kind of tweaking the genetics to a certain extent to come up with modern mankind. And again, that's a very alchemical operation.
Something that always puzzled me about, especially Zachariah Sitchin's interpretation of the Sumerian myth of Enki, was that we're told by Sitchin that Enki came here to mine gold, mm-hmm. and he created a slave race, or genetically engineered a hybrid race that would mm-hmm. be capable of mining this gold. But then he also identifies Enki as the god of smithcraft and alchemy, and I'm thinking, well, if this guy's such a hotshot alchemist and geneticist, why does he need to violate a so-called prime directive, if you will, mm-hmm. come to this planet to create a slave race to mine gold? Why doesn't he just grab a hunk of space rock and transmute it?
Well, I don't know. You know, I'm not a subscriber to many of the details of Mr. Sitchin's scenarios, but you ask a pertinent question here, and I think part of the answer may lie in the fact that we are dealing, apparently, if one takes these texts at face value, and if one takes alchemical texts at face value, then we are dealing with some sort of technology, and a lost one at that. So if we add into this mix the idea that a war was fought at some point, then, you know, any war like that is going to cause tremendous damage to a technological infrastructure. So at a certain juncture, it would appear that this may have been what happened, and that mankind was kind of a stopgap measure, if you will, to try and recover all of this stuff and recover this gold, again, if you subscribe to Sitchin's scenario, recover this gold by other means.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you know, that does raise the question, and again, it's a very pertinent one.
And Enki, of course, is presented as a benefactor towards humankind. He
right.
seeks to help us to exceed perhaps even the level of the Anunnaki themselves, which
right.
then brings up a threat to his half-brother, as presented in the stories, Enlil,
exactly.
who seeks to withhold all of this from us. And Enlil is sort of presented as the bad guy, but when you start looking at the research you've done and say, well, wait a minute, what we're really talking about is the ultimate secrets of the unified field. We're talking about tremendous knowledge that can be weaponized.
Right.
Maybe Enlil might have had it right, saying, you know, these primitive creatures, they're not quite ready for this.
Well, again, I think you're onto something there. I think that this whole mythology that one finds in Sumeria, again, goes back to this whole idea of proliferation of this technology. And I think you're quite right in making that observation, that there are some that did not want to see this get out and into the wrong hands. And of course, Enki being the benefactor, as you say, which is quite true in the Sumerian text, is wanting to place all of this stuff at human disposal. So it is, again, a conflict over who gets this technology and how they're going to use it. And I think you may be on to something there, that Enlil is acting kind of as the spoiler, but in a certain sense, his motivations may not always be bad.
I mean, there are people on this planet that I would not entrust the Philosopher's Stone equals control
sure.
of space-time with.
Nor would I. Nor would I.
So this is kind of an interesting starting point, and it's also mm-hmm. relevant because this is an ongoing cosmic war, isn't it?
Oh, yes, I definitely think so. You know, I kind of left the whole story dangling in my book by that name, but I do think it went underground, and I submitted a book to a publisher just very recently, in fact, where I kind of continue this story because to kind of generalize the topic, because what we see happening after these classical civilizations emerge, Egypt and Sumeria and so on and so forth, is we see a very peculiar association, William, of ancient temples with the money-making power and then with alchemical activity and the pursuit of all of this lost science. So it appears to me that this struggle went underground and continued for through the millennia.
Well, and as you point out in the book, The Philosopher's Stone, which is, again, a masterpiece, it's super well-researched, incredibly well-footnoted, and it's a pure pleasure to read, and I congratulate you on the success of the book. You note that modern fiat banking and reserve banking is indeed a manifestation of the transmutative nothingness of the philosopher's stone,
right,
where from the creation of credit out of nothing, gold is produced.
Right, right.
And the tie-in here, I would think, would be that human energy is the real currency that backs up any kind of monetary value. So it seems like if there is a race of beings that are trying to monetize the human race, and by that I mean take our spiritual currency, our spiritual energy from us, that goes to this idea, once again, of a spiritual war that's unfolding.
Well, yeah, I think so. And again, you know, the idea of banking, there's one codicil I would add to what you say, and that is that the modern banking system, the monopoly that a certain amount of private banks have over the creation of money, and even the whole idea of money as a circulating debt, this is not the original idea of money that one finds in ancient societies. They were very, very much, if you will, kind of precursors to the American founding fathers, that money is a receipt for the goods and services of the state and therefore debt-free and should be issued by the state. But alchemy, in this sense, becomes part of the science of the bankers and, in a certain sense, a perversion of alchemy because, as you say, by monetizing debt and then making it the means of tapping into human labor, human resources, and creativity, they are, in fact, performing a kind of false alchemy. They're creating a kind of negative information and a black hole of debt out of which nothing eventually will ever be able to escape. And I think, you know, we're seeing the fruits of that false alchemy right now.
Yeah, and I'm concerned it's not just the fruits, but it's actually just the beginning of the fruits as
well. Yeah, me too.
Let's shift gears just a little bit, Joseph. Mm-hmm. Never far from my mind is the idea that much of the advanced technology we see around us is either myth-inspired or it's alien-derived.
Mm-hmm.
Athena wore a breastplate that made her impervious to her enemy's weapons.
Mm-hmm.
MIT is building a new suit for the military that does the exact same thing.
Right, right.
You've concluded that the Great Pyramid, for example, was a phase conjugate mirror. You mm-hmm. think of it as the magic mirror of legends.
Right.
Let's talk about that for a second in relation to this alchemical question.
Well, this is an excellent question. The whole basic physics that I see in many of these ancient texts, that I see in many of these structures, particularly the Great Pyramid, is precisely a profound knowledge of the idea of the physical medium itself as being an information-creating creative medium. In other words, it itself is the philosopher's stone. It itself transmutes itself into creation. And therefore, if you know the secrets of this, then you can come up with fantastically powerful weapons. And I think that's exactly what the Great Pyramid was, ultimately. But you also mentioned the whole idea of myth-inspired technologies and the idea that the military is after these suits and panels on airplanes that will actually make things optically invisible. We actually have these now.
Right.
And I do agree with you. I think much of the inspiration for a lot of these things does come from some of these myths, and that raises the question then that if we're coming up with these things by means of our modern science and technology, then we have to go back and look at those myths themselves and see in them perhaps the operations of the very same type of science and technology. In other words, they're not just mythological texts. They're describing real things.
And so piercing the veil of the myth, that seems to be what it's all about, doesn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so modern physics is really nothing but kind of a revelation of the true secrets of ancient myth in that, from that perspective.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with you there. I mean, that's kind of, if there's a motif of all of my books, that's it. You've just stated it very succinctly and aptly.
And so, apart from the Great Pyramid, what's another example of your favorite ancient myths that's been perhaps weaponized in the modern era?
Well, I don't know so much about weaponized. There are a lot of things like, you know, again, the stealth technology that you see being talked about in some of these ancient texts and so on and so forth. But I think, really, if we get right down to it, we are on the cusp of a science that is capable of doing what we see in those ancient texts, blowing up entire planets. We're on the cusp of a science that is talking in genetics about creating chimerical creatures, you know, half human, half something else.
Right.
We're on the cusp of so many things that if you look again at these ancient texts and see what they talk about, they talk about the manipulation of weather and so on and so forth, and again, we see that emerging with modern technology.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all sorts of things that, you know, if you have a particularly perverse turn of mind and soul that you want to weaponize all of these wonderful technologies that we're coming up with, then you need look no further than these ancient myths for your inspiration.
Joseph, we're going to take a quick break.
Sure.
When we come back, let's talk about how this knowledge was lost, and then also how it was regained.
Sure.
This is William Henry. This is Revelations. We'll be right back. This is William Henry. This is Revelations. We're continuing with Dr. Joseph Farrell, author of The Philosopher's Stone, Alchemy and the Secret Research for Exotic Matter. Joseph, first, was there a time when this type of alchemical knowledge was it widespread, or was it always secreted behind closed doors?
Well, that's another excellent question, William. My guess is, in trying to answer that, my guess is that it was probably a closely held technology, at least with a certain class of people or a certain class of gods, what have you. I think, again, your insight about Enlil and Enki and the idea of proliferation of this technology into the wrong hands is a very astute one. So, yeah, I tend to think that it was probably a closely held technology. That being said, I also think it's very clear from some of these ancient texts that the basic idea or conceptions behind it were fairly widespread in the common culture. And I think, you know, the idea now that we have to take these things seriously, you know, you have only to pose this thought in certain circles and be laughed out of, you know, laughed out of that circle. So I think in that sense, the ancient society was a bit more advanced than ours because they were willing to entertain these conceptions.
One of the referring back to Mr. Sitchin again, one of the questions I know he gets frequently is, what happened to these gods? Where did they go? And sometimes he'll just, not really flippantly, but curtly will remark, well, what makes you think they ever left?
Right, right.
Do you think they ever left?
Well, that's a good question. I don't really get into it in any of my books, but it's a very good question. My guess is, just kind of based on my spiritual instincts, is that the answer is no. I think that if you examine what happens after what I believe to be this ancient cosmic war with the whole struggle going underground, I think you can see clear and palpable influence of some sort of spiritual influence at work in some of these struggles. So that would be my guess.
And the reason I'm asking the question, it merged, I was recall reading Nick Cook's excellent book, The Hunt for Zero Point.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And he went right up to the edge of saying, the reason why when we were able to recover some of the Nazi technology and the Nazi reverse engineering of some of these ancient ideas, that he seemed to think we had some difficulty in making it work. And as I'm reading it, I'm thinking, well, of course we would have difficulty making it work. We're not Nazis.
Yeah. Very good point.
I mean, they always made the point that they were part of that pure bloodline that goes all the way back to, in their case, they said, to ancient Atlantis. And maybe there's a race component to this. What do you think?
Well, I don't know so much about a race component, but I do find it very interesting, William, in the ancient texts. I do talk about this in the Cosmic War, as a matter of fact, and kind of hint about it even in the Philosopher's Stone, is that there is some sort of human consciousness component to this technology. And if you couple this with the whole idea that the Nazis had of them being an ultra-pure Aryan race and so on, descended from the gods that came and settled the far north and so on and so forth, it may be that there is some component in there that is related to human genetics. I simply do not know at this stage in my research. But it is an interesting question to pose. I think that there's another component to why we were not able to make it work that Mr. Cook alludes to. And that is that the kind of physics thinking that the Nazis were doing was so far outside of the relativistic dogma that physics had been put into, that our scientists that were trained and steeped in that way of approaching things simply could not wrap their minds around the kind of nonlinear physics that the Nazis were actually doing, and therefore it proved very difficult for them to do, even to the point of the kind of mathematical techniques that one would have to use to do that kind of physics. They're very, very different.
Can you give us an example of such a technology?
Well, I think the primary technology that we would have difficulty working with would be precisely the bell. Now, I depart from Nick Cook's analysis. I do not think that the bell made it to this country. I think mm-hmm. it actually went to Argentina and was continued by the Nazis there. But even let's suppose that it did. The way I've rationalized the physics, William, is that it is a complete abandonment of relativistic type of geometries within physics. It's based on something much deeper and hyperdimensional, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So in this sense, I think our scientists that were simply untrained, quite frankly, to think in these terms would have found it very, very difficult to bring themselves up to speed and think in those terms.
And we almost have to be mystics, don't we?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. There always has to be this kind of well, at least as far as the Anglo-American scientists were concerned, there always has to be kind of this mystical bow to relativity. And at the same time, that gives you a very prosaic kind of nuts and bolts attitude towards physics that the Nazis certainly simply did not have. I mean, they were willing to pursue fifth and sixth hyperdimensional types of theories, and then actually to build technologies based on them. That's the key.
What are some technologies you see in the open literature or open market today that you think could be potentially derived from this line of thinking?
Well, definitely the whole idea of phase conjugation. And for listeners that don't know what that is, basically if you point a laser beam at something way off in the atmosphere and then bounce it back, the atmosphere is going to give you a distortion. And what phase conjugation does is it allows you to account for that atmospheric distortion so that when you beam a laser beam through the kind of grating that's created by that atmosphere, it will appear at the target completely coherent. In other words, it will be a laser beam still. And this whole idea of phase conjugation really comes out of some of these things that the Nazis were doing. In fact, I firmly believe that they actually discovered this physical principle in about 1944 or 45. So, you know, that's one definite technology. And it's very interesting, William, when you look at the record of scientific papers. Most of the papers, the early papers on this phenomenon, were being published in the Soviet Union. And every now and then, you would see a Soviet scientist publishing a paper on, you know, time-reversed waves or what have you in the Western physics literature, almost to see if anyone was really paying attention over here. And when we finally did, it was about 20 years after the Soviets were doing this. So that gives you an idea, a little bit of an idea of how far, in a certain sense, behind some of the thinking in the West really was, as opposed to some of the thinking in the East.
When I think of the Philosopher's Stone, I'm always mm-hmm. going back. Jesus refers to a white stone, a stone of transmutation,
mm-hmm.
as the stone of invisibility. Do you see in your work this quest for enlightenment as being a quest for ultimately for transfiguration and perhaps even the ability to transform ourselves into star beings?
Well, I don't know if I'd put it that way. There is certainly a component of transformation wherever you look in the sayings of Christ and so on and so forth. I tend to be rather traditional in my theological views that I think these things have to be accomplished with some sort of divine aid. I don't think it's something that mankind does wholly on his own. But that said, I think there's also a technological component, and you know, I've said this many times in other interviews. The ancient turn of mind did not make, as you know, the deep Cartesian distinction between the spiritual and the technological that we do now. And I think if you go back and put yourself into that frame of mind that there is some sort of technological and human-based component, you know, to quote St. Paul, we're co-workers. So we have to do something for our own self-transformation other than just sit around and wait for, you know, sit around and wait for God to do it all.
When I take people to ancient Egypt, I'll show them depictions on the ancient temple walls of gods,
yes,
like Osiris riding upon his ship of eternity, and
yes,
it looks exactly the way modern science portrays a wormhole.
Yes, exactly.
And that gets me excited.
Well, it does me too. And, you know, one of the things that I've been investigating with all of this physics that I've been uncovering in these books is precisely this whole idea of torsion. And it's interesting that you mention a wormhole,
mm-hmm,
because torsion is a very peculiar thing in physics. It doesn't seem, in certain mathematical implications of it, it doesn't seem to have those steep, nasty requirements that a wormhole does. A wormhole, as you know, is a very, very tiny, tiny little thing. It's a billion,
mm-hmm,
times tinier than tiny. But torsion seems to be able to accomplish some of these effects without having to reduce things to that very, very tiny little dimension. So, yeah, you know, there is something going on back there. You know, it's very clear that there is some residue of this science that is being talked about and preserved in Egypt and Samaria. And I think, really, we're just on the cusp of trying to recover it all.
And as you mentioned in the closing of your book, NASA's even interested in this. They're in their breakthrough propulsion,
oh, yes,
program. They're,
oh,
they're,
yes,
wanting to know. Right.
They most certainly are. They, you know, and it's a very quiet interest. You kind of have to dig to find them showing this kind of interest. But what's amazing to me, William, is I ran across the name of a German physicist. I'd known him about him for years. His name is Burkhard Heim.
Mm-hmm.
And what's very interesting to me, William, is that Heim will even talk the language of an alchemist. He refers to things as quintessence, which, as you know, is a very alchemical term with all sorts,
sure,
of associations.
Right.
And then when he publishes his physics theory, he decided that he would only do it in German so that it wouldn't get outside of Germany. And then he decided to publish it with kind of a New Age alchemical publisher in Kibbutz. So, you know, he was very acutely aware. And when NASA shows an interest in this man, they simply cannot have missed this connection. I mean, it's palpable. It's there. And for NASA to show an interest in this man, to me, means exactly as you say, that they're showing an interest in a certain sense in alchemy.
Well, and another story that you conveyed in the later chapter of The Philosopher's Stone involved another German, Baron von Puttkamer.
Yes, uh-huh.
In his interaction with Gene Roddenberry, that just flew off the page. Tell us about that.
Well, Jasko von Puttkamer, this is an interesting conundrum I've run into, because there were actually two people, and they were both barons, and they were actually both named Jasko von Puttkamer, okay? And I have not been able to pursue this any further. One of these fellows is the actual naval adjutant to Adolf Hitler. He's on his personal staff.
Right.
He was a tall man, very blonde-haired, you know, just obvious for his tallness. I mean, much taller than your average German. Well, if you go to certain documentaries that were put out in the 1970s, there is a Jasko von Puttkamer that's about the same physical height, that is a consultant for NASA and a consultant for Gene Roddenberry. And I really do think it's probably one and the same Jasko von Puttkamer. Because the other problem that we have, William, in the historical record is that during the war, the Nazis were just absolutely adept at creating doubles, at creating false identities and false trails and so on and so forth. And I think what we have here with this second Jasko von Puttkamer is an attempt to obfuscate a very obvious connection between some of these highly placed German military officers, in this case a naval officer, and then their subsequent career inside of this country in NASA and helping Gene Roddenberry come up with Star Trek and so on and so forth.
Incredible.
Oh, yeah, it really is. It really is.
Recently, Joseph, there was a story that was floated. I'm not sure if it's true or not, but an Ethiopian priest claimed that he's going to reveal the Ark of the Covenant in,
mm-hmm,
Rome.
Mm-hmm.
Based on what you know about the Ark of the Covenant, mm-hmm, about the Philosopher's Stone, manna, and its superconductive properties, what do you think that would, a true representation or a true display of the Ark of the Covenant would be like?
Well, if they have got it down, I mean, if they have the actual Ark, it's clearly, from my own point of view, it's clearly some sort of technological device. I mean,
mm-hmm.
they have made attempts, as you know, to build replicas of it, and discovered that
sure.
when they do, it's an enormous capacitor. It builds up just an enormous amount of static electrical charge. So, yeah, it's clearly a technological device, and if they do reveal it, then it's going to have some very peculiar properties, and it's best that they observe some of those Old Testament precautions on how to handle things.
I'm not sure I'd want to be there.
No, I'm not sure I would either.
So, Joseph, we've just got a couple of moments
sure.
left. What's the next step for you?
Well, right now, as I said, I just finished a book that's kind of a follow-on to The Cosmic War and also to The Philosopher's Stone. It's at a publisher. I'm researching a follow-on to that book, and then I've, in the last couple of weeks, had something come up which I may require me to kind of put that one on hold and write yet another different book on a wholly different subject. But basically, I'm still researching and writing. I have no intention of giving up the pen just yet.
Ah, great. That's fantastic news. Love all your books. Going
well,
again.
Thank you.
Back to Giza Death Star and Giza Death Star Deployed, The Philosopher's Stone. What have you got, 8 books now?
I think it's 9.
It's 9. Okay. Yeah. Well, again, congratulations on the Philosopher's Stone,
thank you.
And thank you so much for taking the time today to talk with us about it.
Sure.
This is William Henry. This is Revelations. The book we are talking about is The Philosopher's Stone by Dr. Joseph Farrell, Alchemy and the Secret Research for Exotic Matter. Hop on over to Amazon.com or the UnknownCountry.com store and get a copy today. You'll love it. See you next time.
Attending a William Henry presentation is unforgettable. Keep up with his schedule at WilliamHenry.net. You've been listening to William Henry's Revelations on Dreamland Radio. Next Wednesday, another cutting-edge revelation from William Henry.